here I am as a 27-year-old and things are going really well. I'm driving two of my dream cars, rental properties, things are going well. I feel like I've arrived. And then, boom, Jesus comes into my life. He rocks my world. And I feel like I need to leave all these things behind. I sold my business for $25K, which was a gift because I felt like I needed to go be a professional Christian. Oftentimes we think that if we're not working in a church or preaching from a pulpit, that we're not doing ministry.
Right.
And that's the biggest lie ever.
JT in the house.
Brother.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always better in real life. But dude, let's not waste any time here. Tell me about where it all started.
Yeah. So you mean how we met?
No. I mean how it started for you. We'll get to how we met.
Yeah. Well, I'm originally from Medellin, Colombia. It seems like it's another world away, but it's only 3 hours away from Florida.
Wow.
It is the epicenter of a lot of crazy things. It's a beautiful country with a lot of, you know, crazy history behind it. Unfortunately, our family was part of that bad history of the country. I grew up in a third generation mafia family. We moved to New York City in 1979.
Okay, so you were a young kid back then.
I was one.
Okay,
so I was one. I was born in 78, and we moved to Jamaica, Queens. My mom was running away from my dad, who was pretty abusive. My dad was a big mafia guy, and he lived that lifestyle. One day, my mom got tired of his abuse and said, I'm gone. So wow. She took me and my sister to New York. And, you know, just when we first got there, we were in total poverty. I mean, I'm not sure how we rented that apartment because we used to collect pennies to eat Lipton soups, you know, canned soups. And so my mom sang professionally in Colombia. That's how she met my dad.
Oh, really?
So, you know, beautiful female. And, you know, she said, I got to go back to work. I got to make ends meet.
Yeah.
So she ended up going to a nightclub that was really popular at the time to sing. And that's where all these drug dealers congregated. So if you know anything about, you know, the 80s, that was a crazy, crazy time in U.S. history, right? That was, you know, it was disco music and cocaine.
Okay.
And
the Goonies and Back to the Future. So,
right.
I mean, let's just be clear.
That's
there
right.
was some good that came out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So she ends up going to these nightclubs to sing, to make ends meet. And she meets all these guys from back home that were up to no good.
Yeah.
So, you know, beautiful woman from back home. Oh, we're going to help you. Well, their way of helping her was bringing her into the business. And so she started at what would be considered a level entry. So we were a house bank. And that's how she got her feet wet inside of the, you know, underground world. We had a house in Astoria, Queens, and had three bedrooms. We were only allowed to be in one, and the other two were stacked with money all the way up to the ceiling. I remember a guy used to visit us. Yeah. So the joke.
Hang on. So you how old?
Oh, I'm a kid. I'm 3-4 years old. You know.
And you're walking into a room that's full of cash.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Dollar bills.
Yeah. So the joke is instead of playing with Legos, I was playing with stacks of money. And it was real. So my mom would always, you know, come in there and get me out because I was playing around with the stacks of money. But at any given point, we could have $2-3 million stacked. I mean, the ceiling was stacked.
For real?
In brown sandwich bags.
And nobody knew the money was that?
No. The whole point of having a house bank for these underground, you know, organizations is, scouting families that don't look suspicious, right? We were just a young family.
But what if money goes missing?
So, you know, they trace you back to your family in Colombia. And if something happens, if that money gets lost, then yeah, unfortunately,
dude,
bad things happen. So we grew up in that environment. My mother, I guess, did her job well and she went up that ladder. She started running her crews from 1983 all the way to 1992, the Southern State of Manhattan indicted her for all sorts of charges. She was going to go away for 25 years. And she wrote a letter to the judge and said, hey, I would stay and pay for what I've done, but I have two young kids and I'm not going to leave them as orphans. So I'm going to flee the country. So she went back. We went back to Colombia. This is 1992, 93. This was a crazy, crazy time in Colombian history. Everyone was after Pablo Escobar.
Yeah.
And so my mother at that time was part of that organization. So whereas here in the States, we were running away from DEA and raids and all, you know, basically police. There it was police, the bad guys, and two other organizations. It was crazy. You show up to Medellin, bombs are going off. There's a curfew. We had to be home at 6:30. There's a drive-throughs. I mean, it was a war. There was a war going on. And we were part of that organization that the government was fighting. So, you know, one day someone came knocking on my mom's door and said, you know, we need information on Pablo. And my mom had a meeting with all her family members and they decided that she wasn't, you know, we were going to leave. So my mom left to Italy with my sister. I went back to New York and I stayed with a family that was supposed to take care of me. And, but yet this family in New York, they were also involved in that business. Okay. They were crazy. They were cowboys.
Really?
Yeah. They weren't in the business of drug dealing. They actually had street soldiers. So they were in charge of, you know, all sorts of bad crimes. And here I am living in this big house. So I stayed there for 2 weeks. It was so crazy that I decided to grab my backpack, take off. So interestingly enough, at this point, I'm 14 years old. I leave and, you know, ironically for 14 months at the age of 14, I'm homeless in the streets of New York, which was one of the craziest things and one of the biggest blessings because I was, you know, I was raised with a, you know, golden spoon. And here I am trying to figure out where am I going to stay and what am I going to eat? And thankfully, you know, my saving grace was soccer. I was a pretty good soccer player. And I played in the amateur leagues in Flushing Meadows Park. That's how I managed to stay in different teammates' homes and get, you know, food and the things I needed. After that crazy 14 months, I went into custody. One of my aunts, who's semi-functional, picked me up. And that's my story. I ended up going at the age of 16 to try out for a team in Spain, in the north of Spain, a place called Zaragoza, between Madrid and Barcelona. I stayed, made the team, and my dreams came true from that perspective. I played soccer from the age of 17 to 23. Ended up playing in Mexico. My career ends early based on a bunch of different things, injuries, and then also just crazy life. Crazy. I was a party kid, you know, and I was playing at soccer at a high level.
Obviously, yeah.
So that ended, came back to the States, depressed for 9 months, trying to figure out how to reinvent my life. And opened up a small gym in probably one of the most gym-saturated areas in the world, 30 gyms in a five-mile radius. So I'm sitting there scratching my head going, how do I differentiate myself from these people?
Right.
So I've always been really interested in process.
Okay, but hang on. I want to stop you because why a gym?
Yeah.
Just because of the soccer thing?
Yeah. You know, you're athletic. I was around nutritionists, you know, personal trainers and coaches. And I always enjoyed that aspect. I was the only one on my team that was annoying all of the coaches. Why do you do that? How come we do that exercise?
Right.
What are you eating there? You know? And so I always had an interest for that, for those things. Those 9 months where I'm depressed and trying to figure out what do I do with myself? I take inventory and I say, you know, what do I do with my life? I don't want to go to corporate America. That's horrible. For me, it was because I think I've always had an entrepreneur spirit. And so I just couldn't deal with the 8 to 5 and all the rules. And so I said, I'm just going to took inventory of my abilities and said, I'm just going to go into business for myself and take all the experience that I have with training. And so I went, got all my certifications, went back to school and opened up my first gym in this place where there were 30 gyms in a 5 mile radius. So then, you know, process has always been interesting to me. That's how I do business. I don't listen to content. I look at process. I started researching, like, what are these guys doing different, these gyms? And what I noticed, the common denominator was everyone was focused on training, right? Exercise. But no one was really focused on nutrition. And I'm like, man, that's the game changer. So I'm going to go after that. And then because I have this crazy entrepreneur mind that just the way my brain is wired, I didn't like any of those protocols that were out there. Keto, Atkins, South Beach, macro counting, calorie counting. I didn't like any of that stuff. I'm like, that stuff, everyone yo-yos. How do I figure out a system that is sustainable? And so we came up with our own system called the Empty Your Bucket Nutrition Plan, which is basically we took all the principles out of all these fad diets, but we took the ones that really, really worked. And then we chucked out anything that wasn't sustainable. And so that's what we've been doing for the past 24 years is helping. Our claim to fame is we help people in 90 days lose 25, 30 pounds and take it off forever. Of course, if you need to lose more, we do that as well. But that's it's a pretty big claim. We do that without people being hungry.
Right.
So, I did that all the way up to the age of 32. 32, I have my crazy Jesus encounter and rocked my world. So, you want to hear about that?
Or? Go for it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I am doing pretty well in business. I'm, at the age of 27, I have a couple of rental properties. I'm driving two of my cars that I had always dreamed of. I thought I had arrived because I grew up in a very materialistic environment. My mom always said, a man is whatever he has in his pocket. Can you imagine? You know? So I had that that tape in my head and I just went out and tried to, chase things, chase shiny things, thinking that was going to fulfill me. So at the age of 27, I'm living on Bayshore Boulevard, which is, one of the most expensive zip codes. I think I have it going for me. I'm dating a Jewish girl. Her dad's a prominent physician in town, and he's opening doors for me. And I'm like, I made it, right? But it was interesting because I always had this void in my heart. I couldn't understand why. I had plenty of money in the bank. I was living the life I wanted, and yet there was this void. And I kept thinking, is this all there is? You know? And I had that very, so I don't know if you've heard people that are kind of bitter about life use that term. You ask them, hey, how you doing? Oh, another day in paradise.
Yeah.
It's like that bitterness,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that was my favorite saying. People would ask me, how you doing? Another day in paradise. Right. But I was burnt out. I was just burnt out because I had hit my goals and yet I felt empty. So I start getting around all the wrong people, partying a little too much, spending a little bit too much money. I was running in these circles with all these rich kids that had a lot of money and a lot of time. And so it got me in trouble. I started to party, drink a little bit too much. That was a gateway into recreational drugs. Got caught up in that world. One morning I woke up, my heart was skipping a beat.
Oh, wow.
Literally. And so went in to work. And later that morning, one of my physician clients came in. And I said, can you check my heart? So he kind of took my pulse. He said, dude, your heart's doing something funny. You should go get an EKG. So I did that. And then the nurse practitioner came in and said, you got to go to the hospital. She says, you're in AFib. I said, what's that? She said, it's an electrical problem in your heart. She says, you got to rush to the hospital. So she gave me a script, got my car, went to Tampa General, and I got hooked up to all these machines. And I'll never forget, I'm laying there in bed and my mind is blown because I own a gym. This is what I'm preaching health and wellness.
Yeah.
I'm at this point, I'm at the fittest I've ever been, right? I look like a poster child for fitness. Here I am hooked up to all these machines.
Yeah.
So this little Asian physician comes in. He was like 4 feet, nothing. He walks through the door. He looked like the guy from Hangover. You know, the guy that comes out of the trunk?
Yeah, yeah.
And he looks at me and says, you've
no,
been
drinking. No, I don't know. I would never watch a movie.
You've
like
never
that.
Watched that movie?
No.
Yeah. So he comes in and he says, you've been drinking? And I said, doc, it's Wednesday. You know, as if this is a weekend thing for me, right?
Right.
And he said, you can't drink ever again. And, in my crazy mind, I thought to myself, this is perfect. This is exactly what I needed to happen. My eyes are open. I'm a disciplined man. I'm running away from this. 2 weeks later, I'm at the party and I'm literally trying to take myself out. I know the doctor said you can't drink ever again. Here I am drinking and doing a bunch of other crazy stuff. And because the flesh can't tame the flesh, right? And so here I am trying to discipline myself, but I'm falling back into all these habits. So I wake up on a Sunday morning, hungover, physically, spiritually, mentally, and I'm writing a letter to my sister, giving her all my passwords because I was going to check out. And, I'm a counselor by trade. So I'm writing these things out. I'm like, man, I'm in a really bad place. I should probably call someone.
Right.
So there's a guy I used to bump into in the elevator of my condo. I was on my way to the nightclub to get faded into the night. He was coming back from church. I would only bump into this guy on Saturdays. And he was coming back from church with a Bible under his arm, beautiful wife by his side. And he just struck me as the most genuine guy ever, right? And I knew he was he was a crazy Christian, right? But there was something about it, about him that I couldn't deny. And that was, he just looked like he was happy. And he would always joke with me and, oh man, you should come to church with me someday. And typical heathen response, oh, the church, you know, the church walls will cave in if I come out. And I was like, ah, you should come party. And he's like, no, I left that life behind a long time ago. He used to be a club promoter and he came to Jesus and left all that stuff. So I called that guy up and I said, hey man, I know we don't know each other well. I said, but I don't think I have another day in me. He's like, what do you mean? I said, I'm going to take myself out. And he said, whoa. He said, those are big words. He said, don't do anything silly. I'm coming over right now. So he comes over and he sits across from me just like this, Bible in hand. And he said, well, let me tell you what God's doing in my life. I said, brother, I'm sorry to tell you, but I don't believe in God. You're going to have to give me something else. And that guy looked at me, Mike, with the certainty of gravity is real, you know, with that certainty. And he looked at me, he said, God is very real, regardless of what you believe. He says, and so is the devil. And he has an agenda. And his agenda is to steal, kill, and destroy. And his agenda in your life is coming to fruition. But Jesus has come to bring life and life abundantly. So I look at him and I go, okay, what do I do with that? He said, well, what are you doing tonight? I said, well, I was going to kill myself, but if you have better plans, we'll go do that. And I was serious. I mean, I reluctantly got in the car, but I said, I'm just going to go through my plans after I get back from this church thing. I'm feeling bad for the guy, right? That's helping me. I'm like, oh, you know, poor guys, you know, let me go to church and accept his invitation. And so we got in the car. We show up to this big building. My only exposure to church had been the Catholic church, because as you know, Colombians are primarily Catholics. And so I show up to this beautiful modern building and I see two things I love, you know, coffee and beautiful women. And I'm like, yes, Jesus, I'm all in. But, you know, I walk into the sanctuary and that day the pastor was preaching a topical sermon on the book of Job. Man, and it hit me like a lightning bolt. And so to the point where I looked at my buddy, I said, did you tell this guy my story? And he said, no. He said, that's how God speaks to us. I said, okay, interesting. Service was over. I looked at him and I said, okay, let's go. And he said, no, let's go to the prayer team. So I said, prayer what? He said, prayer team. So I said, okay. So we start walking in the direction of this young Justin Bieber looking guy. He looked like an innocent Justin Bieber. I'm thinking to myself, what is this Justin Bieber going to do for me? So he's asking me, what do we pray for? I said, well, here's what I have going on. I told him everything I had going on. He said, close your eyes, let's pray. And Mike, honestly, I don't remember a word that man said. All I know is that I was so embarrassed that I was there asking another man for help.
Right.
You know, I grew up in an environment where men don't cry. You don't ask another man for help. But here I was. And what was interesting is he's doing his thing. I don't know what he was saying because I checked out. But there was a moment in time where I felt like I had put my finger into an electrical socket. I felt like literally like energy come through my body. I started bawling like a baby, right? I had no idea why I was crying.
Right.
And here I am just crying. Guy said a couple words to me. I thanked him, walked away. I was probably the last one to leave that church. But as I'm leaving the church, this older man with a fatherly figure comes up to me. He says, son, why are you crying? And up until that point, another male hadn't called me son.
Right.
And that just, I was a mess. So he said, I said, I have no idea why I'm crying. He said, I do. He says, I have a gift for you. So he handed me a Bible. It was just a New Testament Bible. It was a new believer's Bible. I said, where do I even start? He said, start in the Gospel of John. So where's that? So he opened it up for me. And I put a little piece of paper in there. I thanked him, walked out of that church. And I remember waking up the next day, looking in the mirror and feeling like a 1,000-pound gorilla had fallen off my shoulders.
Wow.
It was the very first time that I looked at myself in the mirror. And I felt, I no longer felt that shame that I would feel when I would look in the mirror. And my life started just progressively getting better. I started reading the Bible, and for the very first time, I felt like what I was reading, I was actually understanding. I had tried to read the Bible before, but that didn't get any of it.
Yeah.
But literally, it felt like the words on the page were coming off of the page onto my heart, and God was slowly but surely just changing my heart. So, you know, I've always had this entrepreneur spirit, which is what's next, what's the next project? Yeah. It's like, okay, Jesus, great. I'm here now. Like, what do you want me to do?
Yeah.
So here I am. I haven't even read the book of Genesis, and I want to open a church because I'm thinking right. I've started many businesses. I can make this work too.
Yeah.
Right. But for me, really interesting, I had this whole idea about church. And I remember when I was a non-believer that there was a lot of hangups with people, with church and money. Yeah. So my goal was to have a church in where we didn't depend on people's money. So I wanted to fuel it through business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started a bunch of different things, which thankfully God put a big break. I took a 2-year sabbatical. And I just stayed home, read my Bible, prayed, fasted, asked the Lord to recycle my life. I said, Lord, I don't care what you have me do, but I just want to serve you. And those were, you know, the two best years of my life. I mean, the Lord was really just speaking to me into my life. I met my wife in that time. Shortly after we got married, I was on a 2-year sabbatical and I had some money saved, but you know,
right.
I got married and I of course wanted to be a provider. And so I said, Lord, this is great, but I need to start making some money. What do I do? Because I left the gym business because I thought, oh, this is not ministry. People want abs, but they don't want Jesus. And I wanted nothing to do with anything that, you know, was related to the world.
People want abs.
So, you know, in prayer, God just, you know, he just put on my heart to go back into the industry. The word that I kept getting was to be a light in the midst of darkness. A lighthouse for the Lord. I had no idea how we were going to do that in the gym space because it's such a superficial, carnal thing, right?
Yeah.
For the most part, that's the energy of the gym. But I was obedient. I went in, and shortly after that, our running joke was that we would lead more people to the Lord doing squats and lunges than any church any Sunday. So, yeah, that's the whole story, and it's been awesome. We've moved in very many different ways after that. You know, we sold the gyms about 4 years ago. We're fully online now.
Right.
We're most 99% of our members are Christians. And so we have these amazing communities and we're talking to people about food addiction and then having a multidisciplinary approach to it of theology, the cognitive aspects of nutrition. And then of course, how to incorporate new habits, how to make them sustainable. So that's what I spend my days doing.
So, okay. So this is quite a journey. From New York to Tampa.
Well, from New York to Spain.
Okay.
From Spain to Mexico.
Okay.
From Mexico to, from Spain to San Antonio, Texas.
Yeah.
I was there for 6 months with a second division team there.
Okay.
Called the Pumas. The Pumas sell me off to a team in Mexico, in Guadalajara, Mexico. I'm there for another 2 years. And then 23, almost 24 career just ends.
Okay.
And I end up going back to Tampa, Florida. I went back to Tampa, Florida because I have my aunt lives there. My mom's sister. And so I stayed with her for a little bit trying to, you know, get my bearings and whatnot. So I've lived in a bunch of different places.
So why sell the gyms that were really doing pretty well for you?
Really well. So when I sold, we were at the peak. We had private training studios. So these were small boutique studios. We were training all the shakers and movers in town, all the people, all the news anchors, physicians, lawyers, all the shakers and movers in town were coming to our gym. And so we were, you know, it was for that business, it was very profitable. It was a high six-figure income. We had the gym exactly the way we wanted it. And we had all the equipment we wanted. Everything was going well. And we were going to continue to grow. But when I came to know the Lord, I felt like, you know, I don't think this is where God wants me. This is such a superficial space. And that's why I left. So I actually ended up selling it. I gave it away. A guy that was coming in from California, I sold them my book of clients and my equipment for 25K. I had just one piece of equipment was at 30K. I sold them the whole business for 25K.
Dude.
I wanted out. I was done. I wanted out. I was a baby Christian.
So let me ask you though, in hindsight, was it a smart move? Like, would you do it again?
I think about that all the time. And with what I know now, no, because actually when we went back a second time into the gym space, we realized that that was such an incredible parachurch ministry. You know, we were, you know, like I said, the running joke was we lead more people to the Lord doing squats and lunges.
Right.
You know, we saw people with addictions, you know, put their addictions away, marriages that were falling apart, being restored. We were sharing the gospel. We were leading people to the Lord. We were baptizing people. We were doing, all of our coaches had, we had stacks of Starbucks cards in the desk so that if throughout one of the sessions, someone opened up and had something going on, the coach could take them to Starbucks to have coffee and share the gospel with them or disciple them. So, I mean, it was pretty, pretty impactful the second time around, but I knew better the second time around. The first time I was just a baby and I was rushing to be a professional Christian.
Yeah.
And,
well, there's a lesson there, right? Cause there's people who feel that same way, you know, cause obviously we've had conversations about this and my understanding is you were feeling like the gyms were holding you back from going doing God's work.
Yeah.
But now it sounds like you think the gyms were God's work and they weren't holding you back.
100%. So yesterday we had a powerful conversation and where you said it really well. You talked about tradition and culture and how oftentimes we think that if we're not working in a church or preaching from a pulpit, that we're not doing ministry.
Right.
And that's the biggest lie ever, right? I learned that the hard way. So when I came to Christ, I wanted to go into ministry right away. Yeah. That's why I left my secular job because I wanted to go be a professional Christian.
Yeah.
And then, and I think, you know, God used that time. I needed to be in that desert for a little while. I was very dependent on money because that was one of my idols.
Yeah.
So he stripped me from those things for a while. But then I realized that in order to carry your mission, you know, in this world, you need money. And if you have money and you have the right heart and you have the right mind, then you can put those funds to work well, right?
Yeah.
I was no longer buying, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 bottles at nightclubs.
Right.
You know, my mind had changed radically and my heart was for the lost, for orphans, for widows. I'm like, man, how do we need to make a ton of money to go help these people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I didn't know that. No one told me that initially. The only path seemed to be ministry. And boy, have I tried to knock that door down in many ways. And the Lord keeps course correcting. This is, you know, and sending me and showing me, hey, it's through business that you've had the biggest impact.
Right.
And the most influence.
Right.
So that's something that I, you ask me now after all the situations that I had going to three different seminaries, I'm a seminary dropout. You know, I heard a buddy of mine say, if you don't get kicked out of at least four churches, you're not a real Christian.
Okay. So I got some work to do.
Yeah. So, I haven't been kicked out, but I'm definitely controversial because I just don't take things for, you know, if you tell me something, I'm going to ask some questions respectfully, but I'm going to ask some questions. And I think oftentimes that's not the, that's not what they want. They kind of want to, and I get it.
Paul said that was okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so looking back, I think there are some people that have that very particular call to preach. And that's their thing. I think that it's not common. I think it's probably a very small percentage of people that truly that's what God made them to do, and that's all they should go do.
Yeah.
But I always say, if you have other talents, man, there's such other better ways to be impactful for the kingdom.
Yeah.
And I think business is one of those avenues. It allows you to do a lot of things, a lot of great things, and you know you're a testament of that.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you were seeing real life opportunities to talk to people about your faith, to minister to people where they were at. And you were doing this all in the gyms, mm-hmm. just in the normal day to day of running a business.
Yeah, people would walk through the door and it was just a normal conversation. They would go there to get fit. So we would give them what they came for. And what's interesting is when you can show someone results in your business, maybe you're a realtor and they have a great experience with you and boom, all of a sudden those walls, the trust, right, opens up. So with us, we were in close quarters with these people. Yeah. Some of these people would come in 50, 60, 70 pounds overweight, lose the weight, get super healthy, realize, hey, this guy, he showed up to all my sessions. He's a solid guy. And then they start opening up, you know, I have this going on. My marriage is struggling. My finances are struggling. And so sure enough, we would start, I would always share my story, my testimony, and that would lead into sharing the gospel.
Right.
Most of the time people were receptive. The one or two times I got, can I pray for you? And they're like, no.
This is where I was going to go, right? So somebody's listening and they're thinking, okay, I've got a business, but like, if I start talking to people about faith, is that going to hurt my business? So you had some folks who didn't respond well.
Yeah. Yeah. We had an incident where someone came into our gym. I was the last one there. All the coaches had already left. This guy comes through the door and, I saw when he parked through the cameras, $150,000 car. He comes through, he's right. Looking around. He's like, oh, this is a cool place. And he sits and he says, look, I need to get in shape, but I don't want to do this monthly thing. I want to commit. I want to commit to the whole year. What does it cost me to train 3 times a week? I also want the nutrition. I want nutrition coaching. So, he's getting all basically, the big package, right?
Yeah. The ideal customer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So he pulls out a check. We give him the number. He writes it, four-figure check. And he says, here you go. When can I start? I said, Monday. He says, awesome. Nice to meet you. I'm excited. He starts walking out of the gym and he looks over and he sees on the wall, we have 1 Corinthians 6:19. And he goes, are you guys Christians? And I said, yes, sir. He goes, oh, I can't train here. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, I'm a Jew. And the first thing that came to mind was, that's okay. I worship a Jew. No, he didn't like that answer too much. He said, I'm not going to be able to train here. And he said, I need that check back. And I said, okay. So I hand him the check. He rips it right in front of me. He says, sorry for wasting your time. And he walks out. And that was shocking, right? Because I couldn't believe, I was like, did I offend him? Did I say anything? Okay, fine. Yeah. You saw scripture on the wall, but why is that offensive? If he would have seen it, if he would have saw a Buddha, he wouldn't have been offended, right? But it was Jesus. And so he walked out. He shot me a text 10 minutes after he left. And he said, you have a beautiful gym and you have a great thing going for you. You should just stick to what you're good at. And to which I replied, I think I'm doing that. And that was that. It was hard. It was hard because it was, it was good business. But we said, Lord, whoever you bring through that door, that's your provision. And we're, and whoever is not with what we're doing here, then okay, that's fine. And we had a couple of situations like that. Most people were very receptive and respectful. But more importantly, people just, they saw the interactions and that's what really, really got people's wheels turning. Because, it was the consistency, the discipline, treating people well, being respectful, caring for people, being basically playing out what the fruits of the Spirit say
right.
We should have, but just instead of talking it, just doing it. So people were very receptive to that. And that's why we had great success. It was that whole situation of let's just show up like we're called to show up, like light, like salt. And, that to most people is very, very, they just can't, maybe they don't believe the things you believe, but they have to deal with what they see. And if what they see is showing good fruits, then how are you going to argue against that?
It's so interesting because you're telling that story. I'm in the co-working space, right? Mm-hmm. And so we'd opened a space in Dallas and we finally got the doors open. 9 days before lockdown in COVID.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was just not, it was not the time to open the doors. And so, you know, we're fighting through the summer and this group walked in and they were looking for space for a team, which normally is a good deal, but in the middle of COVID is like, you know, yeah. It's raining money, right? I mean, for every dollar you can fight for. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they tore the space and I don't think it was me that toured them. I think it was one of my staff. And they absolutely loved it. And it was the same thing. They were at the end. They were ready to go. And one of them said, oh, is this Christian music playing? and we play Christian music. Yeah. Not like worship music and all sure. You like know.
Contemporary, but, just contemporary.
Yeah, I mean, you know, decent stuff. Yeah. And we curate it very carefully. We mm-hmm. really try not to have anything that's like very Jesus-centric or whatever. Sure. I just figured that I'm going to have some ambience in the space. I'd rather it comes from a good place
yeah.
than somebody's singing about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? You know, I mean, it's a workspace.
Mm-hmm.
And so my staff member said, yeah. It's like, yeah, same deal. Yeah, we can't work here. He was Jewish.
Yeah.
And actually, I had a really good conversation with the guy on the phone because I saw the email come through, you know, and so I reached out and said, hey, you know, like, let's chat. And it was just a good, you know, conversation. Obviously, different viewpoints,
right?
But it's interesting that as a community, I think what the Jewish community does really well is they keep their money within the community.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fable is that every dollar that's spent in the Jewish community does 12 cycles between other, you know, Jewish businesses. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I think it would be great if Christians tried to do more business with Christians.
Yeah.
If we were good at what we did and we didn't take advantage and all the rest of it that sometimes goes wrong. But it was also interesting that it was the exact same thing. Like, yeah. I can't do business with you. I don't know that I've ever sat there and thought, well, I'm not doing business with this company because of X.
Yeah.
Although Netflix got it in the neck recently with Elon right. and some of the shows they're making. But I do think it would be a good thing for us to think a little bit more about, hey, what kind of companies do I want to do business with?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to give my money over to somebody,
that's right.
Why don't I give it to somebody that's doing some good? You know, for us, we're missional. So, you know, we tell people up front, we have a huge wall in both locations. And it's like, when you work here, you change lives. And this is how, because we take some of our profits
mm-hmm.
and we do impactful things with them.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you believe what I believe or not, I think we can all agree kids should have clean water,
yeah.
you know, and people who haven't got food should have some food. So
mm-hmm.
I don't see the issue here. And I'm not saying that we've got it right either, but I do think just as a point of encouragement to folks listening, think about who you're doing business with.
Yeah.
And don't think it from the negative of, well, who don't I want to do business with? But maybe think of it from the positive of, hey, maybe I should look, you know, a little bit harder at who I do want to do business with and be happy to do business with them, whether it's an In-N-Out burger instead of somebody else's burger, because those cats are Christians and, yep. you know, we know that money's going to go into the kingdom in a right. different way. It just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, I think we're humans, we're tribal. Yeah. We have a tendency to stick to sort of our groups. I think we had Muslims that would come to our gym
yeah.
and they knew we were Christians and they didn't have an issue with it.
Yeah.
And I was very upfront because, you know, they seem like more out there with their faith. So I would see, I had a lady come in and she had a kajab.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, can I train with, and I said, yeah, sure. I said, listen, I'm okay with whatever you believe in. We're Christians. Are you okay with that? Mm-hmm. And she said, yeah, that's not a problem. My husband said that's fine. But with the Jews, it was always a challenge. It was a lot. There was a lot of friction there,
yeah.
which I never understood, right? Because we you look at the Old Testament. I mean, we have the Torah,
right?
We study the Torah.
Yeah,
you would think that we're closer.
Yeah.
from those Abrahamic faiths.
Yeah.
we're closer to the Jews than we are to the Muslims.
Yeah,
and yet that's where we experience the most friction. But going back to what you were saying in terms of like making sure, you know, we're called to be evenly yoked.
Yeah.
And I think that, we should be very conscious of where our money goes. And so I don't throw those, you know, Jews under the bus for not wanting to do business with Christians.
Yeah.
Because honestly, if I go into a predominantly Muslim business and I'm going to take part and I'm going to be there all the time. I don't know that I want to expose myself to their ideologies.
Right.
You know, and so I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. I think we Christians, we need to be more intentional. I think oftentimes we mistake generosity and being nice and being kind and being light with just being a doormat.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to differentiate that. Yeah, we need to be respectful and but we also need to be very selective. And so I personally, I prefer to do business with Christians.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't always play out great, but
I was going to say, you know, I do too, but, yeah. But the reality is, and you can go ask my staff and some of them believe what I believe and some of them don't, but more often than not for us in the office based business in Houston, Texas, more often than not, the problems that we have,
yeah.
My staff will tell me. It's another one of those Christians. Mm-hmm. And that's a tough gig. And mm-hmm. it's not that I'm perfect and it's not that we've got this figured out, but we are trying really hard to do business the right way. You know, we have core values, we have guiding principles, and these things are based on biblical principles. Mm-hmm. I'm not quoting scripture and verse, but this is where they come from. Like we've built a business in the best way that we could figure out how to try and love on people the right way. Like a guiding principle for us is delivering an exceptional experience. Mm-hmm. And that comes from a place of, we're supposed to love people. Mm-hmm. And if I was serving Jesus, is this how I would serve him?
Yeah.
So I think, well, if I'm delivering an exceptional experience, I'd be okay with him getting an exceptional. So yeah. That's the goal that we're going for, right? But they don't necessarily know where it comes from.
Right.
But it's really hard when other people who are supposedly in the family mm-hmm. do really dumb stuff. So. Yeah. You know, if you're a Christian entrepreneur, just can you stop doing dumb stuff?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Is that okay? Can we say that? Like, can you just think a little bit differently?
Yeah.
Instead of being the ones that have the reputation, it's so disappointing that we would have that reputation. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of it, at least in my experience, when I've had friction with other Christians and they've said things such as, you know, maybe they dislike you create a boundary. You have boundaries in your business, right? You have protocols and business guidelines.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't benefit them, the first thing they throw at you is, oh, I thought you were a Christian.
Oh, dude, don't even.
Right. But when I hear that, and generally that comes from a person that is not mature in their faith.
Yeah. No, for sure.
And so, man, I can't tell you how many times I've stepped back from the particular situation and I've said, let's leave the challenge aside. Let's talk as, you know, brothers and sisters in the faith here.
Yeah.
And can I just encourage you?
Yeah.
And then I just use that time to edify them. It doesn't work out very well because people are heated because for some reason you're enforcing, you know, a guideline, an agreement, something of that nature.
Yeah.
But I take that time. And I even say, I learned this from one of my mentors, Bart Azzarelli. Hey, we're not agreeing, but we agree on, we love Jesus. Can we pray?
Yeah.
Can I pray for you? Can you pray for me? Yeah. And it's really funny how sometimes you see walls, boom, fall. And those are those interactions have been really good. I've seen people turn around and go, you know what? I don't agree with this thing and I don't agree with that thing, but thank you. Because most Christians wouldn't stop to do that.
Right.
And so, you know, I think every opportunity is an opportunity to just bring Jesus to the forefront. I have friends that are not believers, and I ask them, why do you interact with me? Right? We don't have the same likes. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do any of the things you like to do. I don't party.
Yeah.
Like, man, you know, I think genuinely you're a good dude. And I'm like, all right, I'm doing my job. I'm doing my job.
But I like that. I like that de-escalation because we don't do a great job of that.
Yeah.
You know, as people,
because you're heated, because we're heated.
No, I know. But as believers, especially, you know, I think it's Jesus, right? No, is it a proverb? You know, if you're on your way to the courthouse with your brother, you know, settle it before you get there. And it's like, de-escalate. That's what he's saying. Mm-hmm. You know, don't keep that thing. And again, it's hard because everything's nuanced and, you know, contracts are contracts and whatever else. So, hey, listen, I'm going to ask you a different question, right? So I know from our conversations, and also a little bit from this conversation today, you wrestled with a heart that loves Jesus mm-hmm. and wants to serve him, mm-hmm. but also being an entrepreneur and a business owner.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this, you know, you were happy to give everything away and give it all up because you thought the right thing to do was to go serve Jesus in a professional ministry role, mm-hmm. right? As mm-hmm. we understand it today.
That's right.
Pastoral staff and ministry, whatever. And you're not alone. Mm-hmm. This is a challenge that I hear a lot. I've experienced it. I wrote about it. I've had conversations this week with other people about this very same thing. So this is very real.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that you've got people who believe in Jesus at varying levels. Not that it's a tiered scale, but there clearly are some levels.
Sure.
And so you've got the folks who, yeah, I'm a Christian, and that means very loose.
They're nominal.
Things, right?
Nominal Christians, right.
And as we mature a little bit, it seems to me, especially in entrepreneurs, and I think it's because we are wired to go and make things happen, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that what happens is we get to a place where we realize, actually, my heart is really tender towards Jesus mm-hmm. and his mission. Mm-hmm. The reason that that's the case is because he created entrepreneurship, in my opinion, as the primary vehicle to go touch the world. So the entrepreneur matures. And what they're having is an awakening moment where the Holy Spirit is showing them his mission is your mission.
Yeah.
Like this kindred thing is happening, but their interpretation of it, because they don't know what to do with it, mm-hmm. is, well, I should just shut everything down and go work at the church.
Yeah.
How do we stop that? Yeah. Like, I'm trying to stop that with the conversations that we have, you know, with the book that I put out, like with the content we put online. That's the moment where you're being awakened to your ultimate calling and purpose as an entrepreneur mm-hmm. to go do Jesus' mission.
Yeah.
How do we stop that misinterpretation from happening?
Yeah. Man, I have so many thoughts around that. I mean, the primary thought is that, you know, I now, with all my experiences, I think that if you are really good at something, then go do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But if all you can do is preach, then go do that. You know, if you're just like JD, I just, you know, like my pastor,
right,
our lead pastor, he was driving a forklift for Sam's Club, and nothing wrong with that, decent job. You know, he's providing for his family, working hard, but he kept praying on that forklift, get me out of here, Lord, get me out of here, because he wanted to go preach. That's all he wanted to do, and he didn't know how to do anything else. So, okay, that's his call, and he's built this great church, and you know he's doing great things. But I just think that when God puts talent in our heart, we have to be good stewards, and we have to know what we're good at, and we all know that deep down. We all struggle with this idea of I don't know, should I be doing this? Should I be? We know what we should be doing,
right?
But I think oftentimes what we're called to do can cause burnout because we're simply doing it transactionally. And right. I think that the way the chip changes when you start thinking missionally and going, man, this is not just about funds. This is about serving people. This is about sacrificial love, which says I'm going to do some things that aren't comfortable. I don't necessarily want to do them, but I am benefiting my neighbor. I am loving on my neighbor. Let me give you a perfect example of that, my business. So I created this organization where I could delegate and have all these trainers and have them run the business for me. But there wasn't anything more impactful than me working one-on-one and actually training a person.
Right.
But you get to the point sometimes, and this is just me being very transparent, where you think I'm too good for that. Or I can go do bigger, higher level things. Sure you can. But those interactions were divine interactions. And sometimes I just sacrificially, I'm not saying that I got to pour all my time into that, but what I've started to do and think about is like, hey, when we open the gyms again, I'm going to take a handful of very intentional clients that I want to create relationships with because I want to share the gospel with them, or because I need to pray for them, or because they're going through something. So I think two things. I think you asked the question, you know, how do we stop that? I think if you're great at something and you can make an impact, go do that. We think of Jesus and the tomb. Whose tomb was that?
Mm-hmm.
It was a rich man. It was a rich man.
Yeah.
What's interesting, and one of the things I heard recently is, had it not been for that tomb that rich man provided, because he had the money to have the tomb, and Jesus borrowed the tomb for 3 days.
Yeah.
Jesus's body would have been disposed. There would have never been a tomb.
Right.
From where he walked out of.
Right.
That was provided by a rich man.
Interesting.
So God uses, I'm pretty sure the guy was an entrepreneur.
You would think, yeah.
And so he sold spices or whatever was going on back in the day, or sponges, or, but you know, we see it all. We see Zacchaeus. Who did Jesus go up and see on that tree?
Yeah.
Zacchaeus, I'm going to your house today. Right. Why would he share with Zacchaeus? Well, he was probably a shaker and mover in his community. He was a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
He was a person of influence. And so Jesus uses people in business more than anything else.
Yeah.
And so I think that if we can become conscious of that and say, man, here's how the Lord has equipped me. Here are the abilities, the talents that I have, and I'm going to put them to work for Jesus. Number one, there's more impact. Number two, there's no burnout. Because I think a lot, I was talking to my buddy that sells businesses, and I said, why do people sell businesses? He says, for all reasons. He says, mostly because they're burnt out. And he says, and they're successful businesses.
Right.
But they sell them because they just get burned out.
Yeah.
So, but they get burned out because it's all about the transaction, not about the mission, oftentimes. So I think connecting to that, to answer your question, just a couple of sentences here is you know, if you're good at something, if God gave you the ability to do something well, go do that. If all you can do is preach, then go preach.
Yeah. Okay, JT, if folks want to get in touch with you,
yeah,
best place to find you.
Yeah, so I'm all over social media, but on Instagram, Coach JT Tapias. Our program is called the Empty Your Bucket Nutrition Plan. Easy way to remember is our YouTube channel is eybplan.com. Like empty your bucket plan, eybplan.com. We post a ton of content in there, all temple stewardship related. This is not just about an aesthetic destination, but instead another way to glorify God through the way we eat and the way we move.
Awesome. All right. Thanks for hanging out.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.